50-50 football. Neil Atkinson with John Gibbons, Paul Dehaney and Rebecca Knight in the studio and over the phone to come. I've got Natasha Henry and David Mooney. And if you've been paying attention, you'll therefore know our focus is very much on the FA Cup semi-finals. And in a way, I wonder how much it is actually on the FA Cup semi-finals. I'll come to Paul second on this, because I had a little chat to him earlier this week about this. There's something which is fascinating, I think, about this Spurs-Chelsea game that's suddenly been dropped in, Rebecca, which is, does it actually have a bearing on the outcome of the title race? In that, whoever wins it will surely feel hugely superior, certainly if they win it well, going into the remaining games of the season. We can think this is just about the FA Cup semi-finals, and of course it is first and foremost, but there is a real element here, I think, where this is going to have knock-on effects.
Yeah, I mean, look, let's not lie. I think right now Spurs probably do feel hugely superior anyway. I would say Sunderland should feel superior after Chelsea's efforts on the weekend. You know, it was an absolute disgrace. It was almost a throwback to last season when you see people like Hazard and Costa completely anonymous. Hazard was stalked by Herrera so badly he's probably still having sweaty nightmares. But, you know, Costa did nothing. He was so much more involved in fighting on the field with Rocco than actually doing anything else. So I think if you look at Chelsea in terms of that, then whatever the outcome this weekend, I think they still have this Premier League maybe worry at the moment, and it almost certainly is. Their defensive record at the moment is quite frankly appalling. It's almost that situation where they literally will have to score at least two a game to win, because they will be conceding. In terms of their FA Cup semi-final, as much as, you know, I love the FA Cup, probably the strongest FA Cup semi we've had in a very long, you know, time, prospect of a good final as opposed to, you know, one that's going to be a walkover by a half time or a dire game until the superior team scores. Yeah, all due respect to the FA Cup, I couldn't care less. I would quite happily not have the FA Cup this weekend and have a Premier League game. Oh.
I'll stop you there. I'll stop you on this, because this is sort of the opposite of where Spurs are. And this, I think, says a lot about the two sides at the moment. Firstly, Paul, that for ages it's felt like Chelsea's to lose the title in general. Mm-hmm. Secondly, that Chelsea have got this, you know, that we were talking on Monday, and the attitude that you and I both had is that you want to see this side win a trophy, mm-hmm. that they deserve to win a trophy, mm-hmm. and that there isn't the same sort of expectation or familiarity with winning league titles. I think both of those things do actually mean that the game is different for both of these sides in terms of both the focus on the tournament itself and the wider picture.
Yeah, I think when I came, we talked in January, I made it quite clear at the time that the trophy I wanted to win this year was the FA Cup. And Tottenham has always had a strong association, or used to have a really good association with it. And we always used to call it our cup. You know, we'd won it eight times by the 90s. And we thought, you know, if you'd have told me in 1991 that we wouldn't win it between then and now, I would have told you were mad, you know.
Yep.
Admittedly, I think we've been in six semi-finals in that time, but we've had a bit of a jinx.
Very few finals, isn't it? Is it any at all?
Not in that period, yeah. No. Six semi-final defeats, actually.
Because I remember growing up feeling as though Spurs were always in at the business end of the cup. You know, even
well, if
when
the
they
year
didn't
ended in one, then Tottenham won the cup.
Yeah. So was that rule?
Yeah.
It's good that they had that rule. It's helpful for Tottenham.
Not this year, though.
But then also, you know, for instance, there's even, you know, 87, the Keith Houchin header is against, is for Coventry, but against Tottenham. Yeah, Tottenham, for me, were, you know, an FA Cup final team.
Exactly. So, you know, the fact that we haven't lifted that trophy for so long, I would bite your hands off for that and second place if you gave it to me now. You know, I know it sounds really weird, because up until we talked on Monday, the league title wasn't even in my, you know, it was just let's finish as high as we can. It wasn't in my thinking. It was only after the defeat against Manchester United that it was like it put a whole new perspective on the way we're talking about things. And it's almost like, you know, I'm kind of on the opposite. I actually could do with the FA Cup game. I think it'll be a welcome distraction, because we've had a lot of pressure games, because we're playing catch up. So we've won the last seven games, and there's a certain amount of stress that puts on you to keep winning, keep winning, keep winning. So I think maybe the FA Cup could be a welcome distraction this week for us, and I'm quite looking forward to it.
John, from the outside looking in, it's interesting that Paul says that. I do think that it almost comes a bit of a shock to Spurs that they're suddenly now in a title race. It is as simple as one win and one defeat, almost, I think.
Or two draws.
You know, the United game is what sort of kicked them into going, hang on, this is a real thing. That suddenly the difference between 7 points and 4 points at this game at this stage of the season is absolutely enormous. And, you know, it's... I think it's almost going to be... I wonder if it now involves a different mindset as sort of what I'm driving at. I can't quite work that out yet. I'm sure Pochettino will be doing everything he can to ensure it doesn't.
I don't think it involves a different mindset, really. I think Tottenham have done well against Chelsea this season, maybe not always in terms of, you know, getting what they deserve in every game, but in terms of their approach, in terms of scaring them and in terms of doing more against them than what other teams have been able to do to Chelsea. So I think Tottenham will approach it, and because of the Ryan High in confidence, will approach it like it's another Premier League game that they can win. I think that's the right mindset. I think it's a really interesting one for Chelsea, because I think normally I would say, going back to your original point about having an effect on the league, normally I'd disagree, because I think Chelsea have been really good this season, are just beating the teams that they should beat. And I think if you look at what Chelsea have got between now and the end of the season, it's teams that they should beat. So normally I'd say, even if they got knocked out of the cup, I'd expect them to bounce back strongly and go on to win it. But no one wants to lose two games in a row at this stage of the season. But it's not great. I don't care who you're playing against. I don't care if it's better teams than what you like. It's going to be. No one wants to lose that. And that'll start to creep doubts into anyone's mind, especially if it gets to half-time in the next game and you're struggling, you're not playing well. The fans start murmuring and things like
that. Your legs are heavy. It's been a long season.
So I think it's become a bigger game for Chelsea based on the back of that Man United result and, as Rebecca says, performance as well.
It almost certainly has. And I mean, it's this mentality that we keep talking about, and that everybody says, you know, at the moment, Spurs are like the form team, and they almost certainly are. Chelsea are not in form at the moment. You know, Spurs have taken like, what, 6 more points in like the last few games than we have. So obviously Chelsea have lost to Palace as well, which was interesting. They've also obviously had the Man United game, which is a big problem. Should Chelsea go and lose again to Spurs, it reinforces even more mentally that Spurs are the form team. Spurs players then are literally going to be like, you know what, it doesn't matter, we've beaten Chelsea now. It doesn't matter if in the league we've got to go and play Man United or we've got a North London derby. This is our year. And I think Spurs have, especially with that side, have the experience and the mentality of last year, what should have been, you know, what could have been, what should have been. I think this year they're on the other side of that almost. And they're literally almost thinking in a way of this could be, if that makes sense. But regardless of, you know, if Chelsea do lose the title, and if they do, I have no words. But if they did, you know, and Spurs maybe won the league, that is phenomenal. If Spurs were second, from a Spurs point of view, that is still absolute progress. And, you know, you've been a top four team now for X amount of years. It's not like when, say, Everton were in the top four for one season and then dropped back out. It's almost like we have this completely wrong mentality now of the top four. And when we talk about the top four, we don't actually speak about teams who are actually in the top four consistently. And Spurs literally are in the top four consistently at the moment. So to be second and potentially win the FA Cup is a huge kind of step forward from last season. Mentally, I think once you win that first trophy, it's going to be huge. You know, Harry Kane all the time talks about this team should win a trophy, this team should win a trophy. Once you do, I think when you look at next season for me, if you do the right business in the summer, and we all know Daniel Levy, and I'm, you know, sure you will, then I think Spurs would probably stone me for saying it, but, you know, probably be the favourites for the title next season. This season, for me, Chelsea will still do it.
Is there something in this, Rebecca, just come back to you on the quick?
Rebecca's touching wood. Any wood she can find.
Well, I'm not that that's the thing. I think that's the point now, is that there's been, for ages, and I've sort of gone through this journey watching Liverpool come close and then ebb away, and Chelsea, and then the gap's bigger. Is there a thing here where it would just now absolutely... I'm thinking about the internals of this side and the dressing room at the moment. I mean, there must be a bit of fear knocking around. No one wants to be the side who's seen to fall off a cliff in a league title chase. It's the worst way to not win the league is to be out at one point 13 points clear and see it slowly but surely wound back in on you.
Yeah, I mean, when you talk about the Chelsea team in the dressing room, like, I've made it extremely clear and I'm not backing down from this point, and I never will. I don't like this Chelsea team. They can win all they want. I still think they're a disgrace for what they did last season. There is no excuse for stopping playing. And then I questioned their mentality, and it was more of the vein of what happens when Hazard falls out with Conte, or, you know, what happens when Conte doesn't back down in a Diego Costa argument and put him back in the team. What happens when they stop playing then? Do we sack another manager? But now it's a question of, do they have the mentality? You know, people talk about Eden Hazard, like Mourinho said it, and I mean, it was the kiss of death, ironically, but, you know, as good as Ronaldo. Well, I'm looking at Eden Hazard in certain games, very, very big games, and he does go missing. Whether it's he's man-marked out of the game, fine, you're not telling me that Messi and Ronaldo don't get man-marked. Of course they do. Top players get man-marked. Gareth Bale, when he was at Spurs, got man-marked. Gareth Bale got around being man-marked and was sensational in his last season. Hazard still, for me, has so much more to do. And I still think, I don't think he'll ever go to Real Madrid because I think he's mentally weak. And I think he would not be able to deal with all that pressure, all the press, every single day raining down on him. So for me, the Chelsea team, yeah, I have huge questions about their mentality. Absolutely huge questions. And again, if Chelsea were to, for example, lose against Spurs, you know, these are fixtures we should win in the title running. Everton away, Chelsea always have great games at Goodison. You know, I remember Drogba and Lampard very late goals when we had Essien at centre-back. You know, there's been great games, but Everton this season are...
And since Christmas especially.
Well, yeah, a very strong side, especially at home. So then, you know, as you say, it's two draws, it's one loss. Well, if Chelsea draw one game, concede a late goal, bad referee decision. You know, for me now, the mentality is all in Spurs' direction. Mm. And more than the players, Antonio Conte, he looked a man bereft. He literally looked like his wife had just told him she was leaving and never coming back. He just didn't know what to say after that Chelsea loss. He'd been tactically outwitted. The players, bar Conte, didn't look like they cared, didn't bother to turn up. You know, we've got these lingering questions over Courtois now because, funny how he can't play, oh, because he was doing an NBA advert. What is this? Literally, what is this? This is, you'd expect that from Pogba. What? Courtois is injured, according to Sky Sports, who, you know...
Sorry, this is news to me.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, so right, before the game, you know, just sat there thinking, I like Begovic. When Begovic played last season, I would have kept him in the team, to be honest, because he looked like he cared. But then they said to Conte, oh, is it true Courtois actually got injured doing a commercial basketball shoot for the NBA? And Conte was like, that's not important right now. So clearly he did get injured doing a commercial basketball shoot for the NBA. You know,
like Kevin Keegan on Superstars all over again. That's one for the teenagers.
It's just, there's just no words for it, you know? So all through the team, I think there are issues at the moment. Mentality is a big problem, but then a win over Spurs and you're looking up again.
Yeah, I mean, looking at Chelsea's form, they tend to have one bad one every now and again, but looking at the history of, you know, post the 3-0 at Arsenal, they've bounced back pretty quickly. As of we, there's not been, you know, a period of results where you could say, oh, they've been in bad form. All right, since Christmas, you've lost to Spurs, Palace, which really, that was one of those where you could have easily won. You didn't actually play badly in that game. And Man United, and only two out of those three games you've not really performed. So it'd be interesting to see what happens on Saturday because, as I said, they haven't played two real bad games in a row, and how that affects the rest of the season. I don't know. I sort of alluded to at the beginning of the week that maybe it might push them the other way, and if they did lose to Spurs, it'd be sort of right, we're going to make sure, you know, this title's up. They've got some strong characters in that dressing room. I don't know.
I think it all becomes a bit death and glory. But all round, I think Spurs are interested in this as well when you're talking about the mental stuff. Spurs playing really well at the moment, Paul. You talked about it on Monday, how well they're playing across the pitch. It's sort of the last remaining mental block, though, this for the football club, isn't it? You know, and now it's almost certain, we can almost put to bed, you know, Spurs are going to finish ahead of Arsenal. You can't say that that's a mental block. You know, I'd be astonished if that turns around at this stage of the season. It's almost mathematically done already. The mental block is getting something in the trophy cabinet, and it's easy to say, well, it's not been these players, but you see, you know, culturally football clubs end up in a certain position in a certain way, and these players, they deserve a trophy off the work they've done last two, even three seasons. They've been responding and playing so very, very well, but they'll know the size of the game that they're coming into here this weekend. They'll know exactly what it means.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that it's a derby and it's against Chelsea, we're always up for that game anyway, but in recent, well, not so much the recent history, but, you know, like pre sort of 4 years ago, we were kind of Chelsea's whipping boys, and you know, we would always lose to them, particularly at the Bridge, and we still do, but we tend to get more draws than we used to. But at home against Chelsea in the last 10 years, I think Chelsea have probably won one at the Lane in the league, which is quite a shock, really, when I look back at the statistics. I mean, you can correct me if I'm wrong on that, but it's not a lot, basically. And also, you've got the Wembley factor. And
I was going to say that, because that's quite interesting now, isn't it? Because you're playing next year.
Well, also...
You want to lose another game at Wembley.
But, you know, everyone says...
I was talking about being famous for the title. I'm backing to go down.
Right. But, listen, these are clever players. They're intelligent players. Eventually, they've got to learn that, you know, it's not going to go on forever where they're not going to be able to play at Wembley. The last two games, we won and we drew when we should have won. We were, Dele Alli got sent off. We were all over them. We were going to batter them if Alli never got sent off. So I saw signs in the last two games that we're getting to grips with playing at Wembley. And I actually think it could get to a situation next season that we might be that good at Wembley that other teams might be saying, hang on a minute. Isn't it a bit of an advantage that Spurs are playing at Wembley and all the major cup finals at Wembley? You know, so it could turn around the other way. Yeah. I feel that our players are intelligent enough to take, you know, this isn't the days when we, you know, we had like three or four really good players and the rest, there were weak links all over the shop. You know, these are, you know, in our strongest 11 is very strong. And even players now that are coming in, you know, are coming in and being just as good. So I bet the Wembley factor, if anything, might be an advantage this weekend because we've played there so often. But it's the FA Cup and anything can happen in the FA Cup. So I wouldn't like to say one way or the other the way it's going to go.
What are the weaknesses that worry you, Paul, in terms just simply on the pitch? Where if you, you know, if you were to be advising Conte not to set up against this Chelsea side?
I don't think we've got any obvious weaknesses in the team. What I would say is the mental thing. What can happen is a team can freeze on a big occasion, you know, and notably over the last few years, we've had some big games and we haven't played the way we normally play, and that's a mental thing more than the capacity as a team, and that worries me because we have still got some young players, and who's to say they go out there and sort of get scared rabbit in the headlights scenario, you know, so that would be my only worry, and also the teams that we've struggled against this season would be Liverpool because they played us at our own game, basically, just harried us and rushed us, and we thought we were good enough to play around it, and we just weren't. Could have got smashed at the Lane, did get beat well at Anfield. And Manchester City away, when we actually scraped with a 2-2 draw, City were all over us in the first half. We could have been three or four down, I'm not going to lie about that, and we come away with a draw. So looking at how... And the other game that stands out to me is Dortmund in the... Europa League the year before, they had that similar fast energy style, so basically the way to stop Tottenham from what I've seen over the last 2 years is play us at our own game. Basically do to us what we do to you. And hopefully Conte's not listening now and he's, you know, he's not going to take my advice.
I don't know if he subscribes. I'll check. He might do.
You never know.
Yeah, I can't see Chelsea necessarily playing that way. I don't know what Rebecca thinks, but it's not necessarily, you know, kind of what you associate with them. I think it's just going to be a really good game, and you're looking at. So I mean, it's sort of looks to me like more on based on what Tottenham are going to do and what Chelsea are going to do. Just because I'm a little bit more sure about what I'm going to get from Chelsea than Tottenham, and as you say, you know, you could. I just feel like there's a bit more pressure on Tottenham. In terms of getting something from the season, but I think they might respond positively to that, and I think it's what Rebecca was saying before about Harry Kane and having that attitude of this team needs to win a trophy soon, and it's responding to pressure in a positive way. That's what good players do, and I think there's enough of them around there to go, do you know what, people are saying nice things about us, but we haven't actually done anything yet, and this is our chance.
I said that on Monday, and I would say that we've actually victims of our own success, because I don't think that anybody envisaged us to be this two seasons in a row challenging for the title. Because effectively, as I said to Neil on Monday, we were the only ones that were challenging last year, whether Arsenal finished second or not. It was already gone when you know, we'd already gone when it had gone. If
it was Harry Kane posting the pictures of Lions and all that, I remember it.
Yeah. And now this season, you know, you would say that we're the closest challengers again. So we're actually victims of our own success in the sense that we're doing better than I thought we should do. And that's brought added pressure from the media because, like, oh, this team's really good. Right, they've got to win something. When really, I think in Pochettino's mind, he's probably thinking, you know, year three, year four, year five is where we're going to really kick on, when the new stadium's open, you know, where we can compete financially. So it's almost like we're victims of our own success, which breeds, if we were to finish second and get knocked out on Saturday, all of a sudden the media are like wanting to sell your players and wanting to...
Well, you get associated as the nearly man and stuff like that. You get a bit of a tag.
Like, by a Leverkusen, remember that famous Leverkusen team, you know, that sort of finished runners-up in everything in 3 years and lost all their players.
I think the thing is, like, especially when you look at Spurs now, the most important thing, and I think the most significant thing, is you are tying your good players down to big, long-term contracts. You are paying them the money that is, you know, I would never say deserve because it's ludicrous money, but is parity to other players of that level. You have no issue doing that. I don't think anybody really believes that Dele Alli and Harry Kane are going to Madrid, let's be honest. 3 or 4 or 5 years ago, it's Luka Modric is nailed on. It is a thing. So I think now you are, you know, with Levy and Pochettino especially, never mind the players, Pochettino is a winner, you know, and eventually...
And see someone you can believe in.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, this weekend for me was the first time I looked at Conte and thought, you do not look like a man who has... any kind of passion or anything, which is ridiculous because he's been the most passionate manager, you know, we've seen since Simeone, and Simeone's a lunatic, you know? So I think when you look at Pochettino, he just has like an unwavering confidence. And I think I heard Harry Kane say, actually, I was watching a documentary on Spurs and the new stadium and stuff. And Harry Kane was saying, you know, Pochettino came in, he brought some of the kids through the academy. He made it very clear, if you are good enough, you will play, but you have to deserve to play. And he was like, it's completely changed the entire mentality of the club.
But I heard that he says to players when they've signed for the club, you've signed for the club to train. Basically, you've got to earn the right to play.
Yeah.
And I absolutely love that, you know, because that goes for any player at any level, whether he's a kid. You know, I've seen him throw in, you know, before Harry Winks got injured, you know, throwing him in over much more experienced players. And you can see that if your nose gets put out of joint by that, or you're going to throw your toys at the pram, just like Jurgen Klopp, he'll throw you out the club and he doesn't care who you are.
He probably shouldn't have done that with Sarko in hindsight. But...
Well, you know, it's one of them.
For another day.
Yeah, I mean, he did it with Townsend, you know, where a lot of people, he had an argument with the fitness coach Townsend and, you know, he's complaining about not playing. He bombed him out and a lot of people, you know, Townsend was in the England squad at the time, you know, but Pochettino was like, well, if you haven't got the right mentality and the attitude to play for this club, you know, Nabil Bentaleb, who was looking like a nailed-on captain for us, bombed him out to Schalke because he was supposed to be injured, went out on a motorbike, fell off his motorbike, got his knee injured. He was like, well, if you can't live like a professional, go somewhere else. And that's what I love.
On to Chelsea, back on to Chelsea. Rebecca, the fitness / illness question here. Are Chelsea expecting the strongest possible 11 to be able to take the field at Wembley, or is it likely that they may still be missing one or two?
It's like illness. I can't even go there. We've gone full like dodgy lasagna and it's so embarrassing. Just take that you lost, take that you were outplayed and move on. It's just disgraceful. Like, you know, fair enough, Marcus Alonso probably was under the weather or, you know, not genuinely feeling well. Costa looked well enough to fight with Rocco, you know, just not well enough to kick the ball. whether Courtois will play or not is, you know, a big, big question. We've you know, that's been asked and answered and we've gone over that. And my tolerance with not swearing can't go another round on Courtois.
You can swear on this, don't worry, but you know, it's better than not.
So Courtois for me is a big doubt. Begovic was at fault quite badly on the weekend, I felt, for one or two things. I don't think he is as commanding. He certainly isn't, you know, as good. There's no way to dress it up. As a second keeper, he is very, very good. I don't think you get many better keepers.
It's like Michel Vern with us and Lloris,
for sure. And, you know, to a lesser degree, even somebody like a Sergio Romero or a Kiko Casilla or a Moya. But at the end of the day, you want your number one starting in an FA Cup semi-final. Marcus Alonso, apparently we go to pieces without him. I'm not sure whether he's shaken off his bug yet, but in terms of the rest of the team, you would expect them to start. The thing that flummoxed me on the weekend was when Alonso obviously went out, it seemed to be this huge... oh my God, what on earth do we do? Well, I thought Conte was this master tactician. If you're a master tactician, losing a mediocre wing back shouldn't really be that big of an issue. But it turned out to be a huge problem. Azpilicueta was shifted to the other side. Kurt Zouma came in slightly out of position. And the most bizarre thing of all was, you know, we promoted Aki to the bench that day. Aki, who we bought back from Bournemouth, brilliant, who actually is a left wing back.
Couldn't believe that.
We didn't play him. Mm. And it's like, you know, where is this playing the youth? Oh, it's nowhere. Where's Loftus-Cheek on his 60 grand a week? Probably in Selfridges.
And how must Aki feel as well? You know, he's getting regular football at Bournemouth, playing week in, week out, starring for them. And it's almost like Chelsea were like, oh, we'll bring him back just in case we need him, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I mentioned this last time I was on, actually. And, you know, the point was brought up by somebody else that maybe it is to see the Chelsea squad train and to get into, you know, the rhythm of things. But as you just said, even if we did bring him back for when we need him, surely when we need him is the crying out moment of your left wing back is not available to play. You clearly don't have a second plan.
On the Willian thing there, I wondered if you might use Willian there. What struck me as odd is that, you know, and maybe this is just our personal sort of, we don't know anywhere near as much, obviously, as Conte about his squad, Rebecca. What struck me as odd was, in moving Azpilicueta, you disrupt the left wing back position and you disrupt the defence.
So you've
got one issue, but you've managed to turn it into two. And that was the strange thing I thought. I thought, you know, if anyone, you can drop anyone into that left wing back, whether it's Ake, whether it's Willian, if you want to be more aggressive, whether it's, you know, you could just have taken somebody who's currently not playing and just got him in there and got him to do your job. Instead, it became this rather convoluted, no, you're the next cab off the rank. You're going to go and do this. He's going to go and do this. And Azpilicueta, for all his strengths, he doesn't come across to me and never has as a left wing back.
No, he absolutely isn't, you know, and it's even more bizarre because when Victor Moses was injured, Pedro, who you would say played right wing back,
a
much, much lazier player than Willian, he is much worse at tackling.
Yeah,
so why does it work for one side, not the other? I think Conte absolutely has his favourites and he has certain players who he will play anywhere if he can, come hell or high water. Regrettably, Pedro is one of those. Willian is not.
Surprisingly.
For me, what's happened to Willian is a disgrace.
Do you think that's got something to do with, didn't one of his parents passed away and he went back to Brazil and had a bit of an extended break?
Yeah, he did.
And he's not got a look in, but he wasn't really getting a look in before that, was he?
Yeah, no, he wasn't in the team before then, to be honest. And I think maybe he is too industrious almost for a Conte side, which sounds ridiculous. But it's one of those things where you look at Hazard and Pedro, the reason they're doing so well this season is because they don't have to do anything bar go forward, you know, and they are maybe more flair players than Willian, which again is in no way a detriment to Willian. I would rather have Willian in my team because all round he does more.
Well, I'm looking at, you know, six categories for each player, you know, whether it be pace, shooting, goals, assists and whatever, I'd probably give Willian, you know, five out of the six categories. Maybe Pedro might take him on pace, but
I think he's great.
But other than that,
he's great.
William's amazing.
Give me a prediction, Paul.
Whenever we've beaten Chelsea at Wembley, 67 FA Cup final.
It's definitely going to have an impact, that, Paul.
No. You'll see where my madness is going. There's a method in it. And then the League Cup final in 2000 and something, our last major trophy. I'll just say something. It was both 2-1 to Tottenham. So I'm going to stick with that. 2-1
Tottenham. 2-1
Tottenham.
Rebecca?
Yeah, I'm going to go 2-1 Tottenham.
What?
I think, yeah. I think Spurs will get two goals after Chelsea get the first goal. I wouldn't be surprised if one of, like, the defenders or maybe, like, a Gary Cahill scored from a set piece and then Dele Alli and probably Harry Kane, you know, get the two. But yeah, I'm going 2-1 Spurs because Chelsea cannot cope with teams like Spurs and Liverpool. Just can't cope with high-pressing teams.
John?
Yeah, Spurs, full house. So Chelsea probably win.
Well, that's all I need. Jinxed.
They're going to call it the Son Heung-min semi-final.
Is that right?
That's what it's going to be called. No, I don't know. I have a sneaking suspicion that Chelsea are going to find a way to absolutely dog it, and it wouldn't surprise me if it's Chelsea in extra time. The other semi-final then is Arsenal versus Manchester City. So back-to-back earlier today, I spoke to David Mooney and Natasha Henry. David Mooney first on Manchester City, and this is what he had to say. Indeed, over to speak to David Mooney about Manchester City with a huge eye on the FA Cup semi-final coming up this weekend. Dave, it's a strange game. I can't really get my head around it. In that, you know, the two sides have shown bits and pieces of vulnerability and fragility during the season, and yet have shown certainly where Manchester City are concerned, tons and tons of class. I saw all of City against Southampton last week, and I was hugely impressed. It looked to me like one of the strongest performances of the season in terms of going to a difficult ground, killing the crowd, getting through a couple of rocky periods, and then being able to second half stretch legs and show class.
I think that's exactly it. I think it was a weird kind of analysis of the performance against Southampton from a lot of people, because it was almost City's game plan to let Southampton feel like they were in the game. And I always felt like Southampton looked as if they themselves felt like there was an opportunity coming, that they might be able to just nick the ball and get a bit of a counter-attack. But City were very controlled in not allowing that to happen. So as they then pressed forward, it allowed space for the likes of De Bruyne and Sané to break through, certainly in the second half, on the counter-attack. And if they can do that again against Arsenal at the weekend, then you would say you'd have to fancy City to actually get something quite positive out of the semi-final. But like you kind of alluded to there, Arsenal are not Southampton, and Arsenal have the attacking players to be able to just pick off City like they did at the Emirates a few weeks ago. And the positive for City at the moment is that they seem to have played themselves out of that little bit of rocky form that they'd had. They had that truly awful run of fixtures where they played Monaco, Liverpool, Chelsea and Arsenal all in kind of four games or so. And what that, just not getting a positive result in any of them, what it did for the kind of momentum was just killed everything that had been happening since they lost Goodison early in the season. And ever since that kind of point, they've kind of looked a little bit unsure of themselves. They had a really nice win against Hull to kind of get back on track. And then the game against Southampton really kind of emphasised the good things that City can do in attack. But there's always that question mark over the defence. And, you know, part of me wonders whether Willy Caballero will be thrown straight back into the team for this one, because it seems very convenient that Claudio Bravo suddenly become the league goalkeeper again just before the big semi-final game.
I think that, you know, before we get on to the goalkeepers, the thing I noticed against Southampton, I completely agree with you, and it's something I've seen City do at times this season. It is that idea of tempt them in. You know, tempt them into think that they're about to win the ball in the press, and then hopefully be able to find the little pockets. If it works, it's great. If it doesn't work, either A, because they're not tempted, or B, they actually win the ball, which, for instance, is what began to happen at the Etihad when Liverpool went to Man City with Yaya Toure. So Toure went from being very, very good at shielding the ball and just tempting Lallana in, and then just found himself completely out of the game and couldn't cope with it. But what I saw against Southampton was it was Toure and Fernandinho at the base of that midfield, and maybe, you know, that felt a little bit, it felt a little belt and braces, and that's one of the reasons why I agree with your analysis, Dave, that City got the game that they came for against Southampton. They were thinking, right, we will be a bit safer. It's not going to be 4-1-4-1. It is a bit more of a 4-2-3-1. We have got two in front of the back four, and whilst they can take turns in bombing forwards, we can do more of this. And I think that's what you'll see against Arsenal as well. I think you will see the two of them there, so that if something does go ever so slightly wrong, there should always be the idea of having one on the cover.
I think that's it. I think the problem that Yaya Toure's got at the moment is that he's built himself this legacy of being one of the best passers of the ball, one of the best kind of midfield generals that the Premier League has seen. But he's not young anymore, and his legs don't quite carry him like they used to. He can still do the passing, and he can still shield the ball, and he can still outmuscle opposition midfielders. But you know, his legs just don't move as quickly as they used to, and I think that's part of the issue. And I think it was very telling that Guardiola didn't use him once the Liverpool game had gone. He didn't use him against Arsenal, didn't use him against Monaco, didn't use him against Chelsea either. And it just goes to show that he wants a little bit more kind of mobility in that midfield. Toure's fantastic for controlling the games when the opposition don't have that fast-paced attack to come through. With Arsenal again at the weekend, I part of me wonders whether or not Toure will actually play.
So do you think he might go back to the 4-1-4-1? Because I'm intrigued by it, because there's more than enough in De Bruyne, Silva and Sané, or Sterling, and drop Sterling in arguably for any of them. You know, there's more than enough in that three, I think, to scare Arsenal, and then the two might give him a bit more certainty. But it's clear that's what he'd rather play all four. He's very much, he's a manager who wants to get his best players on the pitch.
He does this thing. It's kind of like a friend of mine, just going back to the 2012 title win with the Aguero goal. A friend of mine used to say one of the things that Roberto Mancini did on that game was just throw tactics out the window and go, right, you know, Edin Dzeko, Mario Balotelli, get on the pitch and sort this out, because I just want to put all my strikers on. And, you know, I disagreed with him about that. And then you look at what Guardiola's doing. He's going, well, I could take another defender off and put another striker on, because then, you know, I could have even more creativity on the pitch. And it just, at times, I saw his first lineup of the season against Sunderland, and I just sat there wondering, what on earth is he doing here? Because it just seems to be so top heavy. And then he consistently picks his best attacking players. And then in the, you know, in the post-match press conferences, all the time says, well, you know, we need to score goals. And that's certainly kind of part of the interesting thing that I've seen of this season. He is very attack-minded. He might pick what looks like a defensive formation at times, but it's all about getting the ball back and breaking with pace and getting through the opposition lines. So I can see if there's the opportunity to get all four of those players onto the pitch, I can certainly see him trying to take it. I'm a little bit more on the fence, so I suspect what he'll do is he's kind of hold it, rein it in a little bit, simply because when they played at the Emirates a few weeks ago, City twice took the lead through great attacking play, and both times he was really critical afterwards of the kind of mentality switch of just sitting back and trying to defend what they had, and not taking advantage of the fact that Arsenal were on the ropes twice after City had scored, then conceding the equalisers, and, you know, towards the end of the game, they could have lost it when they really should have won. So I think what he'll want is this is a team that can go to Wembley and attack Arsenal consistently. If they take the lead, then continue to attack them and continue to build on that. And I think perhaps if he selects a little bit more of a solid midfield with the two holding players, like you suggested, then there's always the kind of feeling in the back of the players' heads, well, at least he's guarding against this as well, so we can just relax and get on with the attacking side of the game instead of thinking that they have to drop deep. My other worry is who plays at fullback, because Jesus Navas has been I'm not going to say revelation, because he hasn't. He's been somebody who can run up and down the line and, you know, get a few blocks in and tackles. He's not a fullback, but, you know, it's telling how badly City have invested in the defence when that's the option that's at Guardiola's door at the moment. Sanya's injured, Zabaleta's just looking, you know, worse for wear in his legs, so he's picking a winger to try and hold what will be Alexis Sanchez on the day. So there's always going to be holes in that City defence.
I take your point on there always being holes in that City defence. The other thing that occurred to me, though, when I was watching City at Southampton last week, was the thing he'd given himself, and, you know, I think you see this up and down the country, he'd given himself a sub, and I wonder whether or not, again, he's like looked at Southampton with that in mind for this game against Arsenal, in that, you know, if there's every chance it becomes 120 minutes, it's got to be decided on the day. And I was just sort of wondering with it whether or not one of the things that's in his mind with Sterling on the bench is Sterling gives him a sub. And the idea, you know, if Southampton had kept it tight, they hadn't conceded from the set piece, if it had been 75 minutes at 0-0, he can bring Raheem Sterling on. And I just sort of wonder whether or not he might have his eye on that as well, the idea of being able to send that message from the bench to his team, i.e. if he did Torre for Sterling, it's "we're more attacking now, lads." If he does someone else, to be able to say, right, this is what we're about now for the next period of time. And because for all of, you know, the investment that City have made, the bench is in a bit of a funny place at the moment. If you actually just simply take Sterling out of that bench, for instance, against Southampton, it's Zabaleta, Fernando, Kolarov, Caballero, Garcia, and then Iheanacho, who's a very specific type of footballer who it doesn't look as though Guardiola particularly likes. So I just sort of think, Dave, he might be thinking to himself, you know what, I just need to be able to up it on 60 or 75 if need be.
Yeah, I can certainly buy that argument. It's certainly one that I've not thought of either. It's interesting that you mentioned that, because throughout, you know, the takeover era of City since about 2000, and it was probably actually since about 2010 when they really used the investment to make great strides forward. One of the things that a lot of City fans have consistently said, that a lot of outsiders have looked at and just assumed City have great strength in depth, is that City's bench has always not been great. There's been, you know, through Roberto Mancini's time, there was a lot of times when if the first 11 weren't doing it, or the, you know, the fringe players, maybe the first kind of 13 or so players, when you got a couple of injuries and suspensions and whatnot, when they weren't doing it, you looked at the bench and sometimes thought, I just don't see who we can bring on to change this game. And it's exactly the same against Southampton. Fernando is, you know, a half decent holding midfielder. You've got Zabaleta, who is, you know, these days an aged fullback and, you know, can't go bombing up and down like he used to. Garcia's a youngster. Iheanacho, you say, isn't really fancied by Guardiola. I don't think he is either. So if City had gone behind in that game at Southampton, then, you know,
Sterling's the only change.
Yeah, it's the only and pretty much obvious change to make. So I think that could be an option. I think the other side of it as well is, if I'm not wrong on this one, if it goes to extra time, they'll get an extra substitute as well. So that, I mean, a little bit of pace from the bench, certainly an extra time would always be useful. And I think when you think back, for instance, to the League Cup final that City played with Liverpool last season, once Liverpool had equalised in that final 10 minutes or so, I, watching that as a City fan, was very much thinking, you know, Liverpool have got the edge here now, and if there's one team that's going to win it in extra time, it feels like it's Liverpool, because City felt like they'd spent everything in that opening 80 minutes or so. And, you know, if we get into a position like that again on Sunday where City maybe have had the lead and have been knocked back and it's gone to extra time, it could really be a very long extra time period, because Guardiola's not the man to kind of bring on a... You think back to what Mancini used to do. Mancini used to go, if, you know, if we're leading this or if we're drawing this and we don't want to lose, we will make sure we don't concede. Mm. Guardiola consistently looks at it and goes, well, how can we score the next goal? And that, it just sometimes you just worry about the openness of the team sometimes. So I just think, yeah, maybe you might be right on that one.
Next sort of point on it is, you mentioned the goalkeepers there. It does seem convenient that he's pulled Bravo back in as his lead goalkeeper with Caballero to follow. I felt a little sorry for Bravo in the whole match, in that, you know, it moved through a couple of players. It got a little nick. He obviously should save it. You know, he obviously should save it. But
yeah, one thing I will say is, don't ever feel sorry for Claudio Bravo. don't let yourself fall into that trap.
Really, is that the case? Is it?
I've
got to be ruthless with him at all times. Thought he was tidy against Southampton.
He didn't have anything to do, though, did he? That's the thing. The thing with Bravo, and I really kind of fought his corner at the start of the season, just because there's two things that are at play here: the decision to remove Joe Hart and the decision to bring in Claudio Bravo. The decision to remove Joe Hart, whether or not you agree or not that he is a great goalkeeper and would have been better, well, I think there's no doubt he would have been better for City this season than Bravo has been. It's all about what Guardiola wants from his goalkeeper, and Hart for years has continually frustrated City fans by hoofing the ball out of play from you know, dead ball situations, from pinging it long to tiny strikers, that sort of thing. When, you know, there was a big song and dance made about the fact that Guardiola doesn't want his goalkeeper to do that at the start of the season. He gave Hart the opportunity to kind of prove himself that he could do it. And there's a story that broke around about August time about them doing a drill in training about receiving the ball and shifting it onto the other side and rolling it to the far fullback. And Hart was just absolutely hopeless at it, by all accounts. So, you know, you look at how Caballero's distribution has improved over the course of the season. There's no doubt that Hart could have improved like that, but he would have started the season as the number two. And, you know, whether or not he wants that, whether or not it, you know, that's even an option, you know, it seemed pretty clear Hart will be leaving City. So that decision, there's pretty much nowhere to go on it. And the decision to bring Bravo in then on top of that is where you look at and go, well, actually, you know, we know at the last season they were after Manuel Neuer. We know that there was that Neuer was doing a few contract negotiations at Bayern that it seemed like that there was a little hope for City to go in there and get him. It didn't work out. We know that they spent all summer chasing Ter Stegen and that didn't work out. And then you kind of think, well, he's got his third choice there. And if that's what he's kind of settled on, then, you know, he lives and dies by his decision. But ultimately, I think he got found out by the fact that I don't think he expected his goalkeeper to be facing as many shots as he is. And pretty much, you know, there was that stat going around a few weeks ago about about Bravo having conceded 7 goals from his last 7 shots on target. It's a bit unfair because some of them were shots that he probably shouldn't save. But then equally, you've got the goals like the one against Hull, and he's making mistake after mistake after mistake, and it all comes down to the fact that he just doesn't seem to be making himself bigger in the goal. Players come through on a one-on-one against Joe Hart, he makes himself bigger and blocks the shot. Even Caballero makes himself bigger and blocks the shot. It seems like Bravo goes, go on, put it there, and the striker does that and just, you know, nicks it into the net. And there's been a saying going around a few City fans that I know over the last few months or so, that when Claudio Bravo's in goal, it's like having a hologram there, because every time a shot comes in, you just feel, well, it might go in, might not go in. And the opposition teams haven't had to do anything to change their style of play, because they know there's a decent chance that any shot on target might creep over the line at some point. So certainly don't fall into the trap of feeling sorry for him. He can improve, and I certainly wouldn't write him off at City, but I don't see how is Guardiola's long-term plan, given that he's, you know, he's well into his 30s now. He, you know, he, probably isn't going to change too much over the course of the next 3 years, other than the fact that he might stop a few shots. So if that's where it is, then, you know, I think it's one that will probably get addressed in the summer again. And I can see, you know, if Bravo doesn't leave, I can see him being number two next season behind the new signing in the summer.
When you mentioned that, and it's just something that grabbed me as you were talking, really, that Guardiola didn't expect to face so many shots. Is there a feeling around City he's found the verticality of the league sort of quite strange to deal with? I think, you know, there was a lovely little snapshot of Claude Puel post getting a result at the Hawthorns the other week, being absolutely stunned what his side had just come up against West Brom. I think that, you know, we saw it at Anfield last season with Jurgen Klopp, the first time they faced West Brom. But there's been a couple of games where, you know, I think this year the physicality and the speed with which the ball goes back to front in this league at times has come at all levels, has come as a bit of a shock at times to the Liverpool manager. Has Guardiola gone through the same process, do you think, of sort of looking at this thinking, good Lord, this is, you know, there's we're doing a lot of the right things, but that doesn't necessarily mean the right things will work?
I think so. I think there's a lot of factors at play with that, though. I think I think first off, I think he was expecting to have a squad that was better equipped for what he wanted than it is. I think he's walked into a team that has. I mean, the statement that City put out when they announced that he was going to be taking over from Pellegrini said that it were the exact phrase. I've committed this phrase to memory. I've said it that much. But it was following discussions that curtailed in 2012. So they've been after Guardiola since 2012. Since when Mancini won the league, they were actively looking to bring him in then. So they've had, what is it now, 5 years? Well, start of the season, so 4 years to build a team that would be capable of doing what he wants. And they're so far away from being able to just knock the ball around comfortably and deal with that sort of pressure.
Yeah.
That you kind of wonder where the recruitment over the last few years has gone wrong, because City haven't properly strengthened since before they won the title the first time. Every time you've kind of felt, well, they wanted this player, but they've got a downgrade on him, apart from, I'd say, probably Sterling and De Bruyne ahead of Guardiola arriving. And then there's been a couple this season where you'd say there are good high hopes for, but, you know, again, there's been a couple of questionable ones in there as well. So I think there's that. I think the physicality of the Premier League has also taken him by surprise. I think the fact that teams like Everton, Sunderland, Southampton at the start of the season, Middlesbrough as well, who have been in a relegation dogfight, still all took points from the Etihad. They came here and took notable draws at the start of the season. And I think he expected to be able to have a team of players that could play through the teams that would sit back and defend much better than he's been able to. You look at the quality of squad he had at Barcelona and Bayern Munich. I don't think he was under any illusions in thinking that he was walking into a squad of that standard. I think he was expecting to walk into one that was a little bit better than it is and be able to deal with the teams that are, you know, stoic in defence. And I think that is partly something that he should have been better prepared for, but also partly something the club should have been better prepared for. And I think they're kind of paying the price for just having, you know, what I hate to call him this, because, you know, he won a double in his first season, but Pellegrini after that first season was pretty much a caretaker for 2 years. So I don't really feel like the club were putting the right foundations in place for Guardiola at that time. So I think he's had a lot of work to do. And what this season has been is probably what last season should have been, and should have been that transition towards something where Guardiola wants. The big bonus for City fans, though, is that if Guardiola doesn't leave a place till he feels like the project's finished, then he might be here for some time, you know what I mean?
All right, great stuff, Dave. Always good to speak to you. Just let me give me a prediction then for the game at the weekend. What are you expecting to see?
I think it'll be very tight. I think both teams will attack, because I don't think either side can really rely on their defence at the moment. And I can see a high scorer. I'm going to go for a 3-2 City win in extra time, I think. I think it'll be a real nail-biter for both sets of fans.
That sounds like an exciting way to spend a Sunday afternoon, to be honest with you, Dave. We'll take that all day. Thank you very much to David Mooney. Now let's get over and find out what Natasha Henry thinks. From David Mooney in Manchester City to Natasha Henry in Arsenal. And Natasha, it's a funny game, this one. Arsenal, probably broadly speaking, impressive against Middlesbrough. Certainly showed loads and loads of battle. Did well against Manchester City recently. It does somewhat feel like a season on a bit of a knife edge, this one on Sunday in the FA Cup semi-final.
Yeah, I feel like both teams could do with winning the Cup this season.
Yeah.
With them not having, well, definitely not been in the situation now where they can stop Chelsea from winning the league, or Tottenham if they manage to do it. So I think, you know, it's possibly Arsene Wenger in his last few seasons at Arsenal and Pep in his first season at City. So I think it's going to be a hard-fought game. I think both teams will be looking to win and get to a final.
Oh, yeah, I think that, you know, that's undoubtedly going to be the case. It's going to be massive for both of them. I don't think they've got eyes on anything else for this. It was interesting to see Wenger's also made the three at the back move at the weekend. On the Monday night against Middlesbrough. There, it's strange to watch managers who spent a lot of time playing back fours suddenly see the virtue of a back three. But Wenger was the latest one in line to do it.
Yeah, I think it was more the timing of it as well. I know quite a few people that have been championing for a back three for a while. Even I've, on occasion, said that it may have worked against certain teams. So to do it against Middlesbrough, who, not to be rude, but they struggle to score week in, week out. Why are you changing things now? You know, you need to see the real test of change formation. You need it against a bigger team, really, don't you?
Indeed, and that. But it feels as though they've not really sort of... They haven't had the chance to practice it. Maybe he's doing it with one eye on Man City. That'd be interesting, I think. You know, if he goes with Holding, Koscielny and Gabriel... I wonder if he's just trying to solve a couple of problems, get Sanchez more central in behind the centre forward, get solve the idea of who's going to fill in at right back for him. It looked to me like there was, that might have been his thought process, but it is very, very strange to suddenly see Arsene Wenger do that.
Yeah, after how many years and what is it, 32 games now we've played? Why change now? Maybe he is thinking about Man City, but I don't know if we currently have a team that's capable of making changes. Clearly, things aren't as they should be at the Emirates. So wouldn't it just be easier to keep it simple and go out there and play everyone in their best positions and hopefully win?
That's what I would have thought. But he's made the call that he's made. And it could be that he just simply wants to get who he views as his best players on the pitch. It was noticeable, for instance, the back three saw Ramsey and Xhaka in the middle of the park rather than trying to find a way to get Coquelin in to keep one eye on the things behind him. I thought that it's a bold thing, and it also gets him Oxlade-Chamberlain on the pitch, and you get the impression he's been trying to find a way to do that as well. I don't know. I just it struck me as, you know, Bellerin's been so inconsistent with both form and injury this season. It's maybe he just thinks this is going to solve his problems, but it would be huge to do it in the FA Cup semi-final.
Yeah, I mean every time we play at the moment, I'm nervous. So it doesn't matter if there's a back four or back three. I'm always gonna think in the back of my mind, we're going to do an Arsenal, aren't we? We're going to score a goal and then not make it two, and then City are going to come back in the second half and batter us. And it's really depressing to say that, but that's how bad we've been recently. I can't see us challenging City.
You can't see a way through the game at all. I mean, I quietly think that Arsenal might surprise a couple here, but is that the way you just see it? Go and start strongly, don't put them to bed, and vulnerable second half?
Yeah, that is just typical Arsenal, isn't it, really? Or playing in the last 15 minutes and the game's already lost. I just look at, if I'm looking at the two teams on paper, City should win 3-0, especially if you look at form. You know, you've got Sane, you've got Sterling, you've got Kompany back. You know, they're looking like a team again, and it's clearly a lot of confidence. And there isn't that in the Arsenal team, despite what they say in their post-match interviews.
Are you crying this in? A little bit.
Am I crying it in?
Are you crying it in a little bit, yeah.
I'm a bit bunged up, so maybe.
No, I'm just saying that you cry by crying it in. What I mean is, you're saying all the worst things are going to happen because you think if you do that, you'll get the thing that you're looking for. Or do you genuinely sort of, can you see it being a 3-0 sort of game to Manchester City?
I genuinely can. I just don't see any confidence. Everyone's championing Sanchez, which is great. He's still playing, he's still scoring goals. But then they're shouting at each other on the pitch. No one looks like they like each other. And it's clearly not a good environment, and it's not a thriving environment. I mean, we've been awful this side of Christmas. Like, there's no denying it. Even me, who's forever the optimist, I look at City and I just see 6-7 match winners. I don't see that in the Arsenal team. I don't even know if I see three.
Well, but it was interesting he brought Giroud back, I thought, against Middlesbrough. And, you know, it struck me, I've not quite understood the Giroud situation. Maybe I haven't seen enough of Arsenal, but to me, I think he's a quality forward. And I think he's a forward a lot of people would like to have the option of playing, and yet he's been very much on the outs for reasons I don't understand. Is there anything that you know about why he's struggled to get back in the side?
No, because, I mean, originally it was Sanchez was on fire and fair enough, you don't change a winning team. Giroud was coming on and adding goals as a substitute. But I must admit, the past few games, I was expecting to see him, especially after Danny Welbeck, kind of wasn't doing what he needed to be doing or getting the opportunities. You feel like Giroud is he's the complete opposite of that. He's going to come in, he can hold the ball up, and we need to just be a bit more direct. You know, we don't have the leisure or time or games to maybe be playing as nicely as we want to. And Giroud kind of, you know, it means we can be a bit more physical, a bit more strong. And, you know, if we need to play a long ball, we can do.
Looking at it then, do you expect him to stick with this three for City and stick with Giroud? Or do you think he might even just be throwing one out there, because it's going to be difficult for Guardiola to anticipate what Wenger's going to do. I couldn't even begin to pick an 11, to be honest with
you. Then it's the same with Pep, isn't it? Both of them are two men. We couldn't pick their team. We could pick six or seven, but those last few players, we'd both be sitting there like, well, he could, I don't know. Wouldn't it be funny if they both played a three? Like, just complete and utter jokes, comedy value, narrative, whatever you want to call it. Yeah, let's just go for a three. Let's see what happens. But no, I reckon City will probably go for a four. Company's back, yeah, along with Stones. And then probably Sanya to, you know, troll us as a fullback. But yeah, I reckon City will go with a four. I think Wenger should play the Ox because he's been one of the better players in our recent kind of poor form. But I think he's got to play Giroud. I think Giroud's needed to come back for the past few games. And, you know, he just gives us something different. Obviously, Welbeck's out injured. So, you know, play Giroud. Put Sanchez behind him. It worked before. Can work again.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I found quite interesting. There's actually an argument to play something that's not dissimilar to a pretty Wenger-style sort of 1997, 1998, 4-4-2 for yeah. Arsenal at the minute, where, for instance, whilst neither of them are the players I'm about to sort of reference, but, you know, Sanchez and Giroud can be just a little bit ornery in Bergkamp in one way or another. That, for instance, you can have someone, you know, you can have Ozil tuck in on the right-hand side and look to get some pace on the left-hand side, or do it vice versa. It surprised me that he hasn't looked at that really throughout the whole of the season. I was when things were beginning to go wrong, I thought it wouldn't surprise me if you see something that looks a bit Parlour Overmars, if you see something that looks a bit scrappy in the middle of the park, but with players who you can spring with, who've got genuine class, and yet he's really shied away from it.
I mean, if Sanchez and Ozil are the world-class players that they like to refer to themselves as, then there's no reason Sanchez can't drop back and play behind Giroud and be that link between him and the midfield. Because, you know, if you want 300 grand a week, you know, you've got to show you're worth 300 grand a week.
Yeah.
So you should be able to adapt. He's not asking you to go and play in goal. He's not asking you to be a central defender. He's asking you to do something that should come quite naturally. And look, how far into a conversation before we mentioned Ozil, who was just, I don't know what's happened to him. Like, even I can't stick up for him these days. You lot know how many times I've been supporting him.
Well, he got the winner midweek. He got the winner against Middlesbrough on Monday night. So a winner should count for something.
Yeah, but I'm sorry. I've got friends from there, but it's Middlesbrough. Like, they've got the lowest number of goals. What is it, in the top four divisions? They struggle to score week in, week out. So winning 2-1 against Middlesbrough is not some kind of achievement that everyone's making it out to be. I'm sorry.
I'm just trying to build some confidence in Natasha. You know what I mean? I'm trying to find building blocks to look forward to me Sunday afternoon football.
No, I've already dug through to the basement. Like, I'm in counselling. I've accepted Tottenham are going to finish above us. It's a new world order, you know. Trump, Brexit, Spurs being better than Arsenal. I've just got to get used to it.
It's a lovely thing to equate. I'm sure all the Spurs supporters will love that. Who are listening? I think that's absolutely fabulous. That is one of the other horsemen of the apocalypse. Spurs finishing ahead of Arsenal. It is going to happen. Brings it on to the manager, really. I mean, you know, you said it's a game that everyone wants to win. I think I thought previously, like, the two FA Cup wins, it wouldn't have surprised me if Wenger chose that moment to step down. Is that a hope amongst Arsenal supporters or some Arsenal supporters that, you know, just get him a cup final, maybe even get him a cup final and a cup win against Spurs, which would be the, you know, if Spurs did finish ahead of Arsenal but didn't win anything because Arsenal beat them in the final, that's probably like the ultimate dream currently for the Arsenal supporter base. Is there then an argument that that's a perfect moment for Wenger to call it a day?
Well, some fans would say it's a perfect moment for us to lose or not get to the final, finish seventh, and for him to leave that way. Personally, I'm not gonna wish the team bad just to get rid of him. But yeah, maybe I can't help but feel that he's always got this urge to win something, and that's where a lot of his stubbornness comes from. So maybe him winning a trophy would be the best transition for him out of the club. I'd rather see him go that way than see him go on a final loss against Tottenham, where we get battered or lose on penalties.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. I would much rather see him leave with a trophy in his hand, because right now his legacy has been torn to shreds, and it's not very nice to watch as a football fan or as an Arsenal fan.
So are you gonna stick with 3-0 as your prediction? 3-0 Manchester City. That's what you're gonna sign up for. Is that what you're gonna do?
No. Do you know what? I'm going to go 3-2 to Arsenal.
3-2 Arsenal?
Yeah.
In extra
That's
time?
My official. Oh, God, no, because, you know, I've got heart problems and stuff. We don't need that extra half hour.
You just want to sort that out now?
Yeah. Get it over and done with. 90 minutes, that's all I can deal with.
Okay. Always great to speak to Natasha. Let's go back and see what everybody else thinks.
Despite Natasha's somewhat downbeat outlook on that one, John, I mean... They are, in you know, there's a reason why Chelsea and Spurs are first and second. They're being more consistent than the sides who are third, fourth, fifth, sixth throughout the course of the season. We are talking about two sides who've shown fragility through the season, but both did impress in the league last week. I know you were especially impressed by Arsenal at Middlesbrough. No matter how much Natasha talks it down as well, it's only Middlesbrough. There was a togetherness about them. It would have been easy to fall to all the cliches of a tough Monday night in against a relegation battling side up in the northeast. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, completely agree. I was impressed with them. I understand why what Natasha's saying in terms of it is only Middlesbrough. They're probably, you know, I was going to say the saddest team in the league. But then we're knocking about with Sunderland, so it's difficult to say that. But you know, it's not
divine neck and neck.
Yeah, they've give up essentially Middlesbrough, and you know, it's a bit of a shame. It's kind of what's happened there, because it was a reasonably promising start for them. But I think they sort of have give up. But that said, I thought, as you say, the togetherness, the fact that they bounced back straight away after the equaliser, and just the sort of spirit they showed at the end, really. And also, it's not nice playing Monday night when everyone else has won, and everyone around them ahead of them had won games, and that it's playing on your mind. One team's going to slip up this weekend, and you're waiting and you're waiting, and everyone wins, and you're like, oh, it's going to be us. And you know, football fans think like that, so I'm sure the players, it's on their mind as well. And they're also, when you're chasing, it's a bit demoralising as well, isn't it? Because, you know, there's no one to slip in front of you. You can go, well, we can jump in here. So I was really impressed by the spirit. Yet it wasn't the most free-flowing team, you know, Arsenal performance you've ever seen. I think everyone's obsession with three at the back's a bit weird at the moment, to be honest with you, like formations win football games. Oh, you know, just because I just find it very odd. That said, you know, they battled well. I think they got players into the team who were going to fight for them. I think it was right that Oxlade-Chamberlain starts, especially with everything going on with them in the moment, and he played well. And so just having that sort of bond at the end as well, Sanchez giving a shirt away and celebrating together. You know, there was a goal Arsenal scored a few weeks ago where they looked fuming with each other. You know what I mean? It looked like, oh, he scored, I hate him. Do you know what I mean? Like, the lad who doesn't pass him five aside, and you're like, yeah, whatever.
I don't want to count his goals.
Exactly. It felt a bit like that.
It was the West Ham game.
Yeah, the World Cup one. And so... just all very odd. So they seem to have come out of that, and they seem to have a new kind of vigour about them and a new determination to rescue something out of this season. And that doesn't mean they necessarily will, but I think it's a good start.
It's Man City against Southampton, or more accurately, Southampton against Man City. Rebecca, again, a lot of the frailties. That felt to me like a game 4, 6, 8 weeks ago Man City had found a way to lose. Instead, you felt that they were always in charge. There wasn't either one, even when Southampton were on top, and you know, I think there's some lovely bits of play from Stephen Davis, who's possibly the most underrated player in the league. You still thought Man City have got too much for them here. You're waiting for the first goal to come, and then when it did come, you were waiting for the second goal to come, and then you'd have to wait very long for the third.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at City, especially when they've struggled this season, I mean, it's a Jose quote, and I absolutely love it, because I think you can base any successful team and their kind of ethos on it. When you build a house, you don't build your house from the roof, do you? You know, no matter how good your roof is, if your foundations are rubbish, your house is going to fall over. And quite frankly, Claudio Bravo or Caballero, whoever you want to use as your number one, are awful. And that's being polite. It's going to seep through the team. It's going to seep through all the way through. So all season, they have looked nervous from their defence, from their midfield. You know, as Aguero or you know, Gabriel Jesus or God rest his soul, Gundogan, you know, you're kind of thinking, oh God, what are we going to do? We're going to have to score 2, 3, 4 here because the defence are going to be so bad. The difference is Vincent Kompany, because he comes in and they looked so assured. Everybody looked like, for the most part, they knew what they were doing. You know, Kompany was there. He wanted everything, every ball, every header. He is such an important player for them. And in a way, he almost restores that confidence to the back that having, you know, your Bravo or your Caballero kind of takes away. So, yeah, from the minute, even as an opposition player, you see his name on the team sheet and you think, oh, God, you know, we're not going to get the balls. We're going to be second to everything in the air. All of City's team going to be confident. It's almost like the Terry effect that we used to have. Or, you know, if you'd see like a Gerrard or a Carragher or a Torres at his peak, you think, oh God, you know, we're in for it this game. But when you don't see him and, you know, you see your dregs of the defence, you're thinking, well, probably have a good day today, even if you're one down.
And that's why these semi-finals are fascinating, Paul. It is, you know, it is four of the best six teams in the country. You can't get better than that, if you know what I mean, in terms of the semi-final. And it shows, I think, that it's been taken seriously for all, there's always other noise around the FA Cup and the semi-finals, but in the most top 60 season there's been for ages, it's four of this top six. United got beat by Chelsea in the quarter-finals. And it just says, these clubs, say what you want, they've taken the FA Cup seriously enough. And what strikes me is really strange right the way through, all the rhetoric around it has been, all the coverage and noise all year has been all the talk of, well, no one's taking it seriously enough. Well, it's probably been the best FA Cup there's been in years, this.
I think that teams quickly realise, because we have such a strong top six or seven, that the pickings were going to be a little bit more slim this year, and the chances of, you know, normally, you know, probably you'll have two teams that will think, well, we're either going to win the league or the FA Cup. I think that going out the window has made it, the FA Cup, all the more appealing because of that need, really, to have some sort of trophy at the end of the season. You know, we can't win the league. Okay, what's the next best thing domestically? The FA Cup. And I think the thinking has gone a lot around that. And I think even with Pochettino, you know, you'll remember Tottenham were like 2 minutes from going out against Wickham, you know, 3-2 down, playing like a pretty shitty side. Not shitty, but in terms of, you know, youngsters, not really treating it with respect, you know, 9 changes from the last game. Gets the equaliser and we end up winning the game, impossibly. And from that day, it's almost like Pochettino thought, right, hey, I'm not doing that again. You know, I'm taking this seriously. And from then on, we've been really putting our strongest sides out and playing at full throttle as well, you know, against the likes of Fulham. I mean, I think we were 3-0 up for Fulham and we were still pushing forward, trying to, like we were playing, you know, Man United or Chelsea. So I actually like that because, as you know, I've told you already about the romanticism with the FA Cup. So I do think it's become important almost by default. There isn't any sort of magical formula that's happened. Of course, we've had the Lincolns and the Suttons, which has helped, you know, but in the general audience figures and stuff, I'm sure that's helped. But definitely, I think the top sides have had to take it more seriously.
I think the problem the FA Cup's got is the teams who rotate are getting lower and lower. And I think it's, you know, everyone has a go at the top clubs. So it's great. Everyone enjoyed having a go at Liverpool for dropping players and rotating and things like that, because they're the name and you can have a go at Jurgen Klopp and you can say, well, I know him. And, you know, the players I don't know, I know weren't playing. But I think actually the problem that it's, the top clubs can afford to rotate, and we've seen that by the fact that there's four of them in the semi-finals. Yeah, Liverpool didn't get away with one, but we were getting beat by bloody everyone in January. You know what I mean? We could have played, you know, with Legends 11 and then managed to get beat in January.
If they adopt a low block, Sean.
So, yeah, so but the problem is it's crept down the Premier League. The teams at the bottom of the Premier League are rotating now because they it's more important to stay in
Championship.
Championship, that's what I mean. And it's down to the Championship now. And it's just going to get lower and lower and lower. And I was watching Lincoln with interest this year because Lincoln really struggled from all the games they played. They bounce back now and it looks like they're going to win the conference. But for a while, they just had too many games. Then you might get someone like Lincoln going, well, we're top of the conference. You know, I'm serious.
Yeah.
And then, you know, we're better off out of it. You know, if Lincoln hadn't gone up, they still might not, but it looks like they will because John might have messed up a bit. But if Lincoln hadn't gone up, they might have thought, we were the best team in this conference by a mile. And that FA Cup's gone in the way, and you know, there's the money and stuff like that for them. But you know, I'm sure fans might have been sort of suggesting that. So I think where the FA Cup is in danger, and I'm not sure what the answer isn't the top clubs. It's the fact that if it becomes an under-23s tournament for everyone, then I think that sort of kind of takes it out of it, and that because everyone wants to watch Liverpool's youngsters or Tottenham's youngsters because they've been putting them in recently, and City's got an exciting youth team. So I'd watch them on the telly, but you know what I mean? I'm not watching Portsmouth's. and that's the problem. That's the problem that they'll get. And I think that's why people involved in the FA Cup and people who are putting it on the telly, like Gary Lineker, are getting a bit nervous.
But don't you think I've heard many different ideas, you know, giving the fourth Champions League place to the FA Cup.
It won't work because
Portsmouth might win it, or, you know, we're picking on poor Portsmouth here, but they've won it before us, actually. But the point I was going to make is, if all of a sudden the FA Cup prize money becomes 50 million, for example, all of a sudden you'll see a lot more people taking it a lot more serious, because money talks. And this is why...
But I don't know if Sunderland are going to take it more seriously. And so this is what I mean about the problem actually being further down. I think the top clubs might take it more seriously, but then we've got four top clubs in the semi-final anyway. So like, what difference would it be at this stage?
But if a Leicester City or a Burnley, for instance, knew they could get £50 million or £75 million from winning the FA Cup, that can be your transfer budget for the next 3 years. And the point I'm trying to make is, if you look at the Premier League a couple of years ago, Champions League was be all and end all. If you weren't in the Champions League, forget about it. We used to get told it all the time.
Yeah.
Chelsea, Liverpool weren't in the Champions League this year. Man United the year before, I think. Liverpool the year before. Did it really affect you? You know, and the reason why it never really affects you is because all of a sudden, the riches in the Premier League are that great that the Champions League isn't the be all and end all anymore. The Champions League was a be all and end all because of the money that it allowed you to get. Now with the money that we're getting, you know, you're getting bottom club teams getting 100 million.
I think as well, say like you take Spain for an example. So you've got the Champions League or the Europa League, you've got La Liga, and then you've got the Copa del Rey, and that is it. We have the League Cup and the FA Cup. So yeah, great, it's this opportunity to do this, you know, quadruple that's never going to happen for anybody. But there's also the school of thought of, say you're like a Man United or any of the teams, you know, a Southampton, whatever, you've got to the League Cup semi-finals. This is a very convoluted period in the season. Then the FA Cup is kicking up again. Then you've got to look if you're in Europe, which obviously United did not have really, bar the Europa League, they don't have a Champions League issue. Liverpool didn't have that issue at all, neither did Southampton. But then you're looking at that. Then you're looking at the Premier League fixtures, which by January are coming thick and fast. You can't afford to be losing a game on the bounce, you know, get knocked out of a cup.
You've just had six games over Christmas.
Yeah, exactly. So what are you going to do in the FA Cup third round? If you're in the League Cup semi-finals, you see in the final, you're thinking that is a trophy. It might be the lesser, but it's a trophy. Fine, I'm going to play my kids in the FA Cup. And I would absolutely do that, because at the end of the day, really, you know, FA Cup, League Cup, £10 note, two fives. Is it really that different come the end of the season? I'm not 1,000% convinced it is. So potentially, if you consolidated the League Cup and the FA Cup into one trophy, that might be an opportunity. But then again, you're taking away from the League Cup.
I think you could maybe just separate them a little bit more. I think you look at...
I like how Scotland's League Cup...
Scotland, get it out of the way. So I think if the FA Cup started later, I think teams to take it more seriously. I think Liverpool's problem was our fixtures at the time were so grueling that, you know, we'd had two games in 3 days over New Year. We played on the first and the third, and then we had this League Cup semi-final, which is you know, two legs, which is ridiculous. It's completely unnecessary. What did we learn from Southampton 0, Liverpool 0 in that first leg? You know, they just came and beat us at Anfield. Sounds, we should have just done that. And so, you know, it's just this kind of ridiculous situation that we got, Liverpool got ourselves into, where we felt it necessary, and maybe would have done that anyway. But if you push it back to maybe a mid-February start, then I think the league's more or less sorted itself out more, I think, by then. Because, for example, in the third and fourth round, you got Watford rotated players, and everyone's moaning, why are Watford rotated players? They're not going to go down. Well, they don't really know that. They're not quite sure. They're still like, you might say we're safe, but we're on 31 points, and, you know, we don't know what might happen. And so, you know, it's fine you telling me we're 10th, but, you know...
yeah. One bad run, yeah, and you're exactly, thinking, oh, exactly. My God.
But if you can just push it later and later, then I think, you know, teams would start to think, and maybe, I don't know if there's a way to even bring Premier League teams in the fourth round and just do the Championship in the third round. I've not done the maths on this, Neil. I'm thinking on the spot.
I'm enjoying it.
then there's maybe a way around that one when you say, okay, well, look, the more of the league campaign sorted itself out. Here. So yes, some of the teams around the bottom are gonna rotate, and a few more teams will. But if it's more sorted, then I think you can go, you know what, we'll just blitz this FA Cup.
I definitely think there's some mileage in doing the League Cup, actually, not pre-season, but before the season's openers, to have a round of League Cup before that, almost before the Premier League and the Championship starts. And then thus making it finish earlier, the finals out of the way before Christmas, and then, like you say, moving to the FA Cup in February. But also, what we also got to look at is your team, you know, we heard Mourinho crying about it the other day, oh, we've got to play all these games, and I'm going to have to rest players there. If you want success, you're going to have to play a lot of games.
Yeah, for sure. I do agree with that. And I think people would take, for example, the Europa League a lot more seriously if, you know, by the time the Champions League are in knockout stages, you're still in round 569.
Yeah, don't
you
start know, me on that. That's not even funny. That trophy's a joke.
Like, the minute... Well, if Man United win it, it's a very good trophy. But, you know, the minute Pochettino got in there after you got knocked out of Champions League, it was like, we're not bothered. Bye-bye, yeah, see you later. Yeah. You know, if Man United win it and get back in the Champions League... it's their only option at this stage, I think. And yeah, that's great. But in terms of the actual slog and the gruel of it, why would you bother? Well, I remember when Chelsea won it and I was like, God, this is Benitez's final insult to us. Like, he has done this on purpose. Yeah. Nobody cares.
Yeah. I mean, you can't...
Europa League.
You care.
I don't actually want to actually be in it ever. But I
just wish you swerved the Thursdays. Like, I wish you go, do you know what? We're just going to put it on the same night as the Champions League. I don't know, but no one else knows who's going to watch it. But that's fine, because the team's in it, I'll enjoy it more.
Yeah. Call me old school, but I love the Cup Winners' Cup.
so we're bringing trophies back. We're changing dates. We've done all sorts.
But
you didn't see that. That wasn't on the agenda.
That was not on the agenda. None of that was on the agenda.
No.
Quickly, because we haven't done it. Arsenal, Man City, give me a score. In the order I'm looking at, you Paul first.
I'll go City 3, Arsenal 1.
Okay, John.
2-0 to Man City.
4-1, Man City.
Oh, hello.
Fucking hell.
Enjoy that one. Sweet. I'm going to catch you with a brace.
Huge.
Don't remind me of that, man. That's one of my worst days of my life, Elland Road.
All right, then. The other mini thing to focus on, Liverpool, Crystal Palace and Burnley, Man United, two sides who need to make hay while everyone else is distracted. And two sides... In opposition to them, who could very much do with one more win to really take the pressure off. Crystal Palace and Burnley are... I'd be surprised if either of them went down at this stage, Rebecca, but it's, again, not unlike John's Watford example. It's very easy for us to sit here and say that. If you're Crystal Palace and Burnley, you're probably thinking, just three more points right now and we'll get the remainder of what we need along the way somehow.
Yeah, definitely. And also... bringing back to the eternal thing that makes the world go round, money. You know, even if you finish sort of 14th instead of 15th, you are getting more money. And to a side like Burnley, that might be a left back, you know, in the summer. So that is very important, I think.
Certainly with the places as close as they are now, you know, there could be 3 points separating 11th and 17th.
Exactly, and that's huge. And then also it's, you know, goes back to your transfer targets and all that kind of thing. But in terms of like Palace, I think... you know, Allardyce initially struggled. Now they look a much more Sam Allardyce side. Not to rub the salt in the wounds, but Sarko has been, you know, a revelation for them. Like, it hurts me as much as anybody because I paid for my husband to get it on his shirt.
He can't play this game.
Oh, because he's tied, of course. Yeah, yeah. Sorry, I'm a Chelsea fan and we don't do that. We let Courtois play against us when he was at Atletico Madrid. We don't have a buyback clause in Lukaku's contract, you know, so you don't have a sell-on one either. But that's Chelsea life. But yeah, no, for sure. I think 3 points is so important. Again, for Liverpool, I'm pretty much convinced you will get top four. I don't see that not happening. For Man United, I don't know whether, as much as Mourinho, you know, wheels it out, going on and on and on about still not giving up, blah, 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 I really don't think he cared. I think he deliberately wanted to win it against Chelsea.
Well, that's when that came. But you say that, though, but that's what I say, that, Rebecca, though, is that he could very much do with not losing to Man City as well. That one's coming up. He won't want to lose to Spurs. That one's coming up. He won't want to lose to Arsenal.
I'm sure he'll want to lose to Spurs.
As much as I agree, as much as I agree with you.
I think he will as well. Especially if they're in the Europa League.
As much as I sort of agree with you in terms of the... It could suit United, the fact that their remaining games have actually become a series of big games where it'll be tactically tight, it'll need little bits of nip and tuck. First goal's likely to be crucial. Someone who can close a game down is likely to be crucial. I'm sort of at the point now where I'm not writing United off in that, just simply off the basis of it could just suit them, the idea that it's a series of tight games where everyone else they're playing against a bag of nerves.
You know what? They could go out tonight as well. They could go out to Anderlecht. And then if they do go out to Anderlecht, you know, what does Mourinho do then? Then you are thinking, right, well, we are going to have to finish in the top four. We're going to have to beat these teams, you know. They literally wouldn't have a choice. But no, you don't want to be losing a Manchester derby if you're Jose Mourinho, certainly not to Pep Guardiola. In terms of the Spurs game, if they're still in the Europa League, I don't think Mourinho would be crying too many tears if Chelsea didn't win the title this season.
He doesn't want another manager to win the title in his first season like he did with Chelsea, so he wouldn't want Conte to do that.
It's more the players, but him and Conte certainly don't get on. You can see, you know, his relationship with other managers and how cordial or nice it is, and him and Conte.
We saw his reaction in the game that they lost. Man United lost to Chelsea, I think it was in the FA Cup, and the Chelsea fans were giving Mourinho a stick, and he was
which, ironically, because, you know, Chelsea fans are so stupid, they called him Judas and he came back on Easter Sunday, and it's like, did you not think about this?
Yeah, but he like let them know about the titles that he'd won at Chelsea, so that legacy, you know, as much as he talks about, you know, he's a Man United man, he'll still have special feelings for Chelsea, course, you know, yeah. Both good and bad.
I love the man, you know. I think now he will build a legacy at Man United, which is you know, the worst thing we could have probably thought of. But for me, we won't have a greater manager than Mourinho. I love Mourinho, and I hate the way the fans did that to him. I hate the board and the players for it, but you have to move on, obviously.
Yeah, I think with the Liverpool game, I think, you know, looking, just changing tact a bit, I think that with them, if they could win that game against Palace and puts us 2 points behind Tottenham, we'd have a couple of games in hand. Yeah. But, you know, I always say points on the board are so much better. And psychologically, just to be there, do you know what I mean? In case anyone slips up.
And this is why this is major for Liverpool, John, to be honest with you, is the points on the board, games in hand thing. From a Liverpool point of view, it's as much about putting the gap between Liverpool and Manchester City as much as it is. It looks like the battle for fourth is between United, Arsenal and City. Suddenly it looks like Liverpool are in their own little category above. That's why I think, you know, we're talking about the Liverpool side, they've got a bit of an injury crisis, we'll go on to in a minute at the back there, but it would really strike a blow to put Liverpool sort of, oh look, they're on Spurs' coattails, not the just the only just.
I'm not thinking about Spurs at all, to be honest with you, and I mean that in the nicest possible way, Paul.
What, not thinking about catching us, or just not thinking about us?
I don't think we can catch you. Don't think that's going to happen. That's not something I'm thinking about.
I'd like to hear that. But also,
I think it's more the points on the board thing is not to look at Spurs looking over the shoulder, it's to get Arsenal looking and it's bloody hell, it's 12. You know what I mean? And we haven't even played and suddenly it's 12 points, and that's a lot of points at this stage of the season. I don't care how many games you've got, five games in hand and it still look like a lot.
Well, if it's for City, it's 5 points. And again, that looks like at this stage of the season, that just looks like 5 points.
And they keep winning and, you know, they've got Neil at centre-half and they've still won. Do you know what I mean? It's that sort of thing. And so I'm thinking about the hammer blow to those below us, really. I think there will be a real big win, and, you know, there's going to be kind of a, you know, some casualties, this, you know, because they can't all win. So, you know, if you've got knocked out the FA Cup and then suddenly it's 12 points, that's a tough thing in the middle of May.
And so on the injury crisis, it was at centre-half. Liverpool have got no Lucas, no Matip, no Clavin. From the look of things, I mean, there's the wonderful quote from Klopp when he was asked what is it that you're actually going to do, and he said, I don't have to solve this right now. Which is, you know, a philosophy we can all live by. But there is,
it's not one that exists in our office
and perhaps needs to. There is something to be said for, you know, he might see who we can patch up and get in there, or it could be that Liverpool are playing Joe Gomez alongside Dejan Lovren.
Yeah, he brought up Joe Gomez as a possibility. It's quite a scary one, really, because the last time he played for the first team was against Wolves, and he got sort of bullied a little bit. It's a long time since then, which is both a good thing and obviously a bad thing, because it just means he hasn't had a lot of high intensity football recently. He is playing for the under-23s, but it's a big jump between Mark and Kids and Mark and Christian Benteke. If Liverpool play well, it doesn't matter who Crystal Palace have got up front, because he won't see the ball. But you know, we're not in a brilliant run of form at the moment, even though the results have been pretty good. You know, we've not been tearing teams apart. We've not been looking like we've kind of got that in us.
Well, it's those centre-halves with no Lallana, no Henderson, no Mane.
Exactly, and that means you can't drop Emery Can back, which would be another option, especially at home. You might say, okay, well, Emery's a big lad. You know, he's played centre-half, albeit in a free mostly. And you might think, well, you could do a bit of that and he could be your ball playing centre-half and he's not going to get bullied. Well, he can't do that because he hasn't got enough midfielders. And so you're in a difficult situation, really, in terms of what to do. But as I say, that, you know, you look at the quality that Liverpool have got, and you look at what Crystal Palace are likely to do, which is to sit very deep, and you think, well, you should be able to negate, you know, who's the centre half, really.
And also, John, just go back to you on that, Palace are also going to have no Mamadou Sakho, obviously, no Scott Dan, probably didn't play the last game. So it's not as though it's easy for them at centre-back.
It's not, and Saku's been playing so well, it's almost a bit of a disadvantage in this game, because, you know, he's been flying for them, he's a fan's favourite, and, you know, if you're a Palace defender, you're thinking, oh yeah, this guy's great, he's sorted everything out, and then suddenly he's not there. That can actually be a bit of a negative when you're kind of a bit over-reliant on someone, especially without Dan as well, who's a real leader for them. And so they will be feeling a little bit precious themselves. They will be feeling a little bit kind of nervous and a little bit vulnerable at the back end. So if we can exploit that and get at them early and with attacking football, then they're going to have as many kind of, if not more, kind of nervous moments than we are.
I'd say on the plus side from Palace's point of view, though, you know, look, going forward, Zaha, who we were linked with at the beginning of the season, and all Spurs fans were sort of laughing at Pochettino saying, yeah, what are you doing? And then as the season's gone on, I'm like, actually, I could see Pochettino turning this guy into a world-class act.
You Klopp know, he's, as well.
And Klopp, yeah, he's definitely stepped up to the plate. And, you know, I was talking earlier about us Spurs not having that Mane-type player who can give you that outlet when you just need a little break every now and again. He could definitely be one of them. So he's going to be dangerous. And of course, you've got the case of the ex, which I always have to refer to with Benteke. You know, he didn't have a good time at Liverpool. He's going to want to show people. And Andros Townsend as well, who I know very well. So they've got an embarrassment of riches really up front. And if they can click, it could be worries.
Get the ball to them. Okay. Burnley remain powerful. Obviously, they'll play Ashley Barnes. He'll make everyone's day awful. It's his job, and he's very committed to it. Mostly the Man United players, but also just everyone watching. Broadly speaking, we'll come away from that going, good Lord, I'm glad I don't have to watch Ashley Barnes every week, though he is phenomenal at what he does. And he's fast become my favourite player and least favourite in equal measure. Always keep an eye out for him. I'll have your predictions, Liverpool, Palace and Burnley, Man United. I'll go to Becca first.
So, oh, Liverpool Palace. Oh, I've married to a Liverpool fan and I really don't want to see him cry again. So I'll go 3-1 Liverpool.
Okay, and Burnley?
1-0 Man United.
1-0 Man United. John?
I think Liverpool will win 2-0. I think Burnley will get something. Score draw.
2-1 Liverpool and 1-1. Burnley, Man U.
Well, okay. Worrying number of clean sheets knocking around the place. We haven't got time really to go into the relegation picture, but it's fine. Hull and Swansea are sorting that out for us. Bournemouth probably beat Middlesbrough this week, which means that all the fears around them dissipate, and it's down to Hull and Swansea to go right the way through. But anyway, thank you very much indeed to Natasha and Dave for joining us on the phone, and to Paul, John and Rebecca for being in the studio with us. Sit back, relax, enjoy the FA Cup semi-finals.